it isn't like some of them couldn't for reasons beyond their control. And so I just wanted to point that out because we brought that up before. It is, it, as an example, it's a good one in terms of incentive. In another sense, it isn't perhaps the ideal example. Charlotte?
Kind of some of the other differences are for a six-pack charter, to increase their marketability is an important benefit. For a spot charter that comes to last the once in the blue moon, having this marketability rating is not going to be as big a deal to that company. So the benefit is much decreased. And the due diligence point I was trying to point out is not so much that you just don't have the stars, but you end up in court being fined over spill damage, which is different from trying to attract customers by your safety rating. They will look at things and say the list says to have a double hull vessel would be a recommended prevention measure, and you had a spill, you only had a single hull measure. It can be used against your recording due diligence. You did not take due diligence. And that's what I'm looking at. Not that you just didn't have the star. I mean, that does come out in the public relations event, but it's the actual due diligence.
Right. And I think that was the other part of Senator Pierce's question. She asked, I believe, if there had been any problems with that, and I don't know whether anybody answered that.
A five-star vessel meets all the first four requirements, which frankly seem pretty, to me would be pretty standard. It's making me think I'll never get on with this guy.
Unless it's a five-star.
I've always said I wasn't going to get on a boat that didn't need a pilot, and I'm really believing it. But this says the five-star vessel meets all four requirements and has on board a properly installed and serviced approvable inflatable life raft that'll hold all the people on board. So that means if you don't have five stars, you don't have a life raft. So, or even an inflatable buoyant apparatus, whatever the heck that is. But, so, I know we've had some six-packs sink. Do we know whether the experience has been that when they got to court and it was found that they didn't have five stars and therefore didn't have an inflatable life raft, has that been used against them?
I knew that was part of your question. Captain Hutmacher, do you have any idea?
No, I don't know, and I would think, Senator, probably the ones here, the incidents that resulted in us essentially pushing this five-star program, you know, this is all pretty recent. It's all very recent, so there's really no history, but we don't have any information about that, whether or not. Because in reality, it's every one of these vessels have met the existing U.S. regulations, whether they have any stars or not.
Right. You need to change your U.S. regulations.
I'd like to get back to this this business of burdens here, and I think that we can safely say that he's suggesting what we just talked about, and that he has brought up a couple of other incentives other than the ones that we've talked about. We've already talked about reduction in state penalties for spills, and if you look on this little grid that he's prepared, you can see that he takes that to specifics there. And then he suggests these other two things, one of which we've touched on, frequency of filing a seaplan, which would be reduced on a tiered basis, and then the full deployment spill drills, which are currently required once every 3 years, apparently. He's recommending that reduction on a tiered basis also. And then finally, then he gets into the state awards program. So maybe we could just add the frequency of filing a seaplan and the full deployment spill drills to the list of incentives that we have, because we've already got reduction in state penalties on the list. So those other proposals that he's making that we haven't already talked about or have on the list of the sea plan and the full deployment spill drills. And comments, Mr. O'Hara?
O'Hara, I have a question. ADEC, are the non-tank vessels going to be required to have a full deployment spill drill as part of their sea plan?
Susan Harvey, we have not discussed drills or inspection criteria. I know in some of the preliminary discussions we talked about, if everybody ends up being a member of the co-ops are tested full deployments through the federal and the state requirements on a regular basis. So if you're a member of a co-op, that's probably how you would satisfy that. I can't imagine a full deployment drill of an individual plan holder for this type of vessel. But this has not been discussed, and I think the answer from our standpoint was no.
Well, let's take it off the list then.
But let me also clarify, this is Susan Harvey. I'm not sure where Gene, what he would meant by currently once every 3 years. The current regulation in the state of Alaska is that we have authority for each plan holder to drill 2 times a year, to do agency-initiated drills for existing regulated facilities, which include tank vessels, onshore facilities, everybody else. The reality, and he probably got this from me, the reality is with my staff, I try to make sure that once in a three-year period, each one of them is drilled 1 time in a three-year period. That's about all we can cover. So that's more like the reality, but we do have authority for existing facilities to do 2 times a year.
I'm thinking about a 5-star fiscal note, though.
I don't know who was first, but Jim Carter, Doug Lynch, Paul Foos.
Paul, I just want to ask a question. You've looked into the insurance. Do you think the insurance company coverage would not require a drill of a ship ever so often?
I don't know. I'll check into that. I mean, I've asked them for the full range of things that they call, count as credits and what they want, what they want to have done.
Question. Doug?
I was just going to note that the federal NPREP program for drills does require the exercising of your worst-case scenario with your spill management team at least once every 3 years, and that might be what Gene was alluding to.
Okay. Larry.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to again to the question on what are we building here,
right,
and the size of this. And when we're looking at Gene's chart here, okay, the part about this we haven't talked yet is the tier 1, 2, 3 at the top. When we were prepping and getting the materials together for this meeting, we're talking about the idea of providing incentives for people to voluntarily do prevention measures. And we've gone the whole range from reducing your response planning standards to an award system and a whole bunch of stuff in between. And we heard a number of the arguments for and against. The incentive system that you build here is what, the one you select here is what drives how complex this and big this system gets. Because let me just by way of example, just recap what we talked on the most simple end of an incentive system. And all of you that were there at that meeting, correct me if I'm going astray here, but we said, well, let's just make this incentive system as simple as possible. Because when you start, if you put in a tax incentive, for example, okay, now you're talking about reduction in money. Now your suggestion that the department better get out there and make sure they really have the prevention measures. So the rigor and the oversight and what we need to do all increases depending on which measure you select.
Right.
If we go to the bottom end here, which is one we discussed, which is simply the award one, for example. Okay, we said, first of all, this is not a homogeneous industry, and that led us to coming up with 5 categories of vessels, and then we went through the list of things, and we said who's eligible for one and who isn't. But that, and Cap Page got on to really go through and sort out all of the international and federal requirements is really quite a complex chore. And so this is just a smattering. And that led us to decide then that, well, there's a whole bunch of other things out there that fishing boats might be able to do that aren't even on this list that we aren't even thinking about. And that led us to think that there should be an addendum here then to allow any category of vessels to come in the door and propose a prevention measure and have it be added, have it be accounted for. And I think there was general agreement that that would be a good idea. If it was on an award-type basis then, if you did that, then what kind of award would you get? And then we talked about 1-star, 2-star, 3-star. As soon as you talk about a gradation in the award, then you talk about weighting all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Gene doesn't have here under Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3. He hasn't told us here how we're going to weigh this whole matrix of prevention, prevention measures so you know for your category of vessels whether you're qualified. So when we're talking about doing that, to get to Heather's point, we really got a lot more work if that's what we're building. And this system is really getting, it's going to get big, and then it is going to drive perhaps the need to have inspections, to have oversight and do it. If we just took the simple system, which is the one we discussed at the end, which was the ward system should be self-nomination. You're on the honor system. If you've got a prevention measure that's not on the list, you can propose it. And if you want an award, then you fill out the form, you send it in to us, you apply for award, and have a very simple, non-graduated award system to address Charlotte's concerns about penalties and due diligence. And it's just, you're above and beyond recognition, or above and beyond compliance. And so you've gone beyond what's required by law, and you have this, and this on your boat, period, amen. So,
period.
Yeah, period. End of story. Simple system. I don't have to talk to Senator Pierce about the five-star fiscal note in that scenario, which has its advantages. So we need to think as we're thinking about all of these and taxes and ones with monies and this, some of these really drive the need then to be able to not only list these but then to weight them and to provide a system that will take in a new one, properly weight it and add it in. And so it's a lot.
Yes, I agree. Charlotte.
Alone. And I agree with everything you said. This is Charlotte McKay. You know, and also, look, I think the greatest reward that, you know, credit that comes out is what has it brought before. It has its own consistent reward. It's your own risk reduction to yourself, your own cost reduction to yourself, your own avoidance. And maybe a very simple thing that could be done is that maybe there's a quarterly newsletter where people submit and choose their own form of what pollution prevention measures they've taken on and what benefits them, which would encourage other people or give ideas to other people to give them incentive to do that as well. And nobody's being graded, and you're avoiding this whole credit program that is always a wonderful idea, but always seems to have a million pitfalls no matter where you try to apply it. But you have this newsletter out there, and people are creating their own PR. They're generating what they think is their risk reduction. It doesn't have to be quantified for equality, but we think it does this. They get some recognition for that. Quoted here or there elsewhere, distributed somehow. And it's a very simple way of passing the good word as well and getting some recognition. Mm-hmm.
Brad?
One of the things I did was to look, spend a little bit of time looking through the database of what vessels have already registered with the financial responsibility forms. What's there? You know, we've got 1,000 vessels on the database, 300 of which were in Alaska waters last year but haven't filed anything this year, which would tend to indicate they either haven't come or aren't coming. And when you look at the ownership patterns and you look at the kinds of vessels, I guess the question it raises in my mind is, if you're trying to affect behavior, an award is not going to make a big difference to somebody who is calling only once a year. They're not going to care whether or not they get an award. So what that led to was the question of maybe the award program and some of the recommendations that would lead to an award would only apply to vessels that call in Alaska ports 3 times a year or more, that the whole program is designed for the more regular vessel. And by excluding any vessel sort of from the whole program, maybe we avoid what Charlotte has raised, is if we're not recommending it for them, then they can't be penalized for not following the recommendation. If the focus is on the vessel that's here, you know, X days a year, X visits a year, I'm not sure what it is. That doesn't mean they're bad prevention ideas for that group, but we don't create this negative for the group that really isn't going to take advantage of the program, while we have a positive for the group that will take advantage, which is the fishing vessels that are here all the time, the container ships that are here all the time, the processes that are here all the time. So that's one thing I'd offer just in sort of thinking about how an award program might apply in looking at the actual vessels that are that we know are here.
I guess we're in the category of other proposals now. Paul?
Yeah, well, actually, just responding back to this and what Brian said, I was going to mention the same thing. If vessels don't feel like they can meet this and don't want to participate, then specifically exclude them. If bot charters don't want to be part of it, just eliminate them from the program and say they don't qualify for prevention credit. I know I wanted to keep it the same for everybody, but the question comes down to either we're going to do something like this and weight these things and make a meaningful program, or otherwise, let's just completely forget about it. So the policy question is really, you know, for Senator Pierce and for Michelle Brown and for the full task take a look at. Do we want a real program here? Because if we, or if we just go like, say, well, if you meet any one of these, you're above and beyond compliance and you're going to get a reward, that's not really a prevention incentive program. It's the simplest way to do it. So do we want a more complex system? And if we do, and it's going to take a couple more staff to do it, then I don't know if it isn't even possible if this would fall under something that could be funded by the 470 fund, because this is definitely prevention, and it's in the league of what that money was set aside to deal with. So I don't, I mean, those are all political questions that I know some of the industries that have, you know, gone above and beyond would like to see some recognition. If we can, I like this matrix, you know, without, just take everything out of here, all the blanks. We're going to go through what prevention credits work and don't, and if we want to weight this thing, then we can do that. But I think Gene's come up with a good model here, and if I thought of, like, completely excluding spot charters if they don't want to be in it, but maybe it's better, like Brian says, if you put, not, don't single out one industry, but say if you're here less than three times a year, then you don't have to, you don't have to meet the requirement. But we could also, the fishing, if, or, I mean, the voluntary program.
It's not a requirement.
It's not a requirement. You wouldn't be eligible for those.
You wouldn't be eligible for the prevention award.
Credit program.
You came here if you were.
I thought you meant you wouldn't have to meet the law.
Well, you have to meet the law. You just wouldn't do this voluntary prevention program.
There was somebody in the audience who wanted to speak, I believe. I don't know your name, sir.
Oh, no, I didn't have anything I wanted to say at this point.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I misunderstood. I think Charlotte, Stephanie, O'Hara. No? Charlotte?
I'm venturing this as much a question as a statement, but I'm not sure that vessels know if they're going to come into less water 3 times that year or not. I'm not quite sure how that shipping schedule is set up, but you may have a vessel that thinks it's coming 5 times, 3 times. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how big a deal it is.
O'Hara?
O'Hara here. As far as I know, the most dangerous ship I've been on was a one-time caller. I don't know about the new Clarissa, how many times she'd been there. If she had been there frequently, she would have anchored a mile off the beach in a Northwester. I think the Kirishio was a regular caller, but Kirishima was a regular caller. But I don't think this idea of three a year is not prevention. Second thing, an awards program for spot charters could go to the folks who charter them rather than to the ship. If Kaminko gets a attaboy from the state for chartering decent ships, then there's an incentive for you folks, that the awards ceremony wouldn't be for the ship.
That's assuming, and we may
Charlotte
control over which ships we get, but my understanding is if we were a lesser profit commodity, or if the price of zinc were to fall again, that you kind of get left with what the other companies haven't chosen, and that is not under your control. So you're being awarded or not awarded on something that you don't, may or may not have control over, depending on availability and market.
Jeff?
I have a question just for Charlotte. This is Jeff Thompson. Charlotte, given that circumstance, have you as Kaminko given any thought to mitigating your non-control, perhaps, of quality of ships by thinking in terms of having any terminal or land-based response that you could extend to the ships that visit?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we don't fall into this venue, period.
Theoretically.
So theoretically, we haven't gone down that road since we aren't in that road, on that road. But and some of what I'm putting out there is not just Kaminko. I'm trying to be, for a variety of situations, not here as a Kaminko spokesperson. But that is why I added to the list the suggestion of things that could be done so that the person with control has some they can take, such as staging fishing equipment, which is my suggestion, and the suggestion for meteorological oceanographic systems or membership in contractors, maybe that type of thing, to help alleviate some of that risk. But I think there was a factory, which perhaps could happen, but you don't necessarily have control over it.
Pretty close to it.
You're going to want to save the ship, the nicer ship, more closely, and you're going to try to do what you can, but you still are not in the same situation of control as a
Okay, I'm going to try to move this along a little bit unless somebody has a pressing comment. I think what we have here is the list of all the prevention incentives, I would like to call them. And we have full deployment field drills. I'm a little unclear on that. I guess as far we should leave it in case it becomes part of the picture. Right now I'm hearing from Susan that it may not be a requirement. Full deployment spill drills for the non-tank vessel category?
Susan Harvey, DEC. Once again, I think it really depends on what we end up doing in terms of sea plan compliance. If you join a co-op, as Doug had pointed out, they get drilled. If you don't join a co-op and you do it all on your own, we made a decision that drills are warranted.
Okay.
And I have
federal requirements.
So it's got to stay on the list. Jeff?
Senator, I would say as far as including it now as a recommendation of the task force, you may want to, but as a sea plan group, we will be looking at this issue directly,
right,
and we'll be making a recommendation in our own.
Okay, if it's required, the consensus would be that a reduction in frequency would be an appropriate credit.
If we decide to do the whole thing altogether.
If it's going to be required at all.
And if it doesn't, conflict.
Doug?
It's not a federal requirement. It's a voluntary program that you can join, and by following it, you meet not just the Coast Guard, but MMS and RISPA and EPA's requirements for drills. And one split on that might be to consider, because one of the things we were talking about in the RPS work group is spill management. So rather than exercising a full deployment of all the equipment, you still may want to exercise your spill management. That's the ones that are going to keep you. Your decision process is kind of keep you out of a lot of trouble.
That probably belongs on the list of prevention measures rather than this list. Right?
You said prevention measures.
That's what he just said. The exercise of the spill
management.
Sea plan frequency. Should we keep that on the list? Provisionally, I guess, the provisional list. And then the state award program. I think that's got a lot of intricacies to it that we maybe can't address right now because, as Larry has pointed out, there is the list that we come up with of the measures probably is related to this in some way. I don't know. I think that if we get bogged down in coming up with a state award program in detail right now, we're going to be here for the entire day. I mean, that's just my impression. We have to talk about the concept rather than the details right now. That's all I'm saying.
I would say that of the things on that list, the state award program has the least tangible reward overall. Because, first of all, there's a lot of charters care less if they get a star from Alaska, and frankly, I don't know that so you get a piece of paper that says you got an award, while it might work for my first grader, it's probably not a great incentive in business where there's dollars attached. So I would say, of all those things, it is the least tangible. It's very costly to the department, and I would think you would just leave it off, and let's not try to talk it to death anymore.
Larry? May I ask you a question? How do you feel about the state award program, did you say?
Well, I think the one we talked about in the work group I think we wandered away from an award program. We ended up talking about the thing. It was a simple recognition. And all of these are have the same degree of difficulty in that whichever system you pick here, you're trying to create an incentive for somebody to add a prevention measure on a vessel. And if we're getting into weighting this stuff, that's where it starts to get complex.
Okay.
The state award program, I think the simple version of that we ended up, because we talked about an equivalent five-star type of program, would have been to just boil it all down, and it's not a weighted thing at all. It's just, it wasn't really an award. It was a recognition program, okay? And so you simply, if you went, we talked about the five-star, we talked about the home energy one. What's that called? That's a five-star insulation house. And there's the ABC program. So there's a number of recognition models out there. The ABC is above and beyond compliance. And we kind of talked about the above and beyond compliance as the equivalent or the substitute for the award program. And what is that? That just means that if you did anything on your boat that was above and beyond what's required under federal law or international law, whether it's on the list or not, because if it's not on the list, you can tell us about it. And if it's reasonable, we'll include it. And you simply get recognition that you went above and beyond recognition because you got these prevention measures. And if you were towed, you had a long list. Maybe if you're a little fishing boat, you only did an enhanced training program. And that's it. That's
okay.
Recognition for that. No waiting, and that's all you get.
Okay.
It's not a credit. What it does is it basically creates peer pressure. It gives something. It's the same as a five-star. Then it's all, I mean, all of this stuff is voluntary anyhow.
So
to me, the incentive works. I mean, I hear Charlotte's point on the due diligence, but I've never encountered it in any of our settlements. I mean, when you get into settlements here and the bottom line on these standards of care issue and stuff, I mean, we're always in the position, you can't go above or beyond what's written down in regulation, that's it. Anything voluntary, anything else, is not anything that we've ever been eligible to recapture fines, penalties, or anything for. So to me, that this will work as an incentive. It's
okay.
Pretty minimal, but... so I don't know. I think it depends on how we build it. I don't know if these other ones are going to stay in or out.
So what? Okay, let me just recap what I'm hearing here. Senator Pierce was saying that you thought it might be expensive, but what you were talking about was a complex program that would be expensive.
Yeah.
If it was a simple,
if you did the complex,
I think you weren't here when you were talking about that part of it. That there was a recognition potential that would not be expensive and that would be very simple, wouldn't require budgetary changes and so forth.
Right, and I think what I was hearing here was if we went that route, then it doesn't have enough value, you know, it doesn't have enough incentive to then go, I don't know if that's your concern, but you know, will that be enough to cause anybody to do anything? And that.
O'Hara
here. Every ship I get on, they have plaques on the in the wheelhouse, AMVR awards, you know, recognition from federal and state, even local. Government. So if this program were to go national, this would, people would want that kind of recognition. So I can see it has an advantage.
It certainly has no cash.
No.
If there's already a federal program of some sort or some other program out there, why can't we just acknowledge that the ship already has that rather than trying to make up a whole another?
I don't think there's a federal prevention.
Nothing there.
It's only for, like, AMVR is Automated Vessel Emergency Response, and they then the NOAA comes out with an award for compliance with weather reporting. Who else? Hamilton, Bermuda has their own little award program that you see on cruise ships.
Yeah, there are some comments in the audience, I know, but I thought I had some comments coming from this direction. No? Okay, there was this gentleman here. I'm sorry, I don't know your name, and then Captain
Hamacher. Yes, my name is Joel Lebeau. I'm with the Alaska Center for the Environment, and if I'm speaking loud enough, that's terrific. It seems like an award program for vessels makes sense to me. If you have a level one award, level two award, the folks that are chartering vessels have the option and say, gee, what kind of award do you have? What kind of equipment do you have? If you don't have this equipment, we don't want you. I mean, then you don't get tarred when they have a problem. That's up to you. I mean, you can make those decisions. And thanks.
Okay. Captain Huttmacher and then Scott Carter.
Yeah, what I would just say is, I handed this to Lieutenant Commander Eccles because I just saw it this morning, but we're talking incentive programs, and I know something, the Coast Guard's been involved in this port state control activity for, you know, for quite a few years now, 6 years or so, and it's been pretty effective at targeting substandard vessels and essentially attacking that problem. Now, what they're going to do is Admiral North has just announced a new incentive program that they're calling QualShip 21. And what they're going to be doing, this is going to be for foreign flag vessels. And essentially, it's going to be based on our force state control program and how vessels, what their record is under that. Now, the incentives that they, essentially they talk about here is for, they're going to do some of the basic award things like Captain O'Hara talked about. If you qualify for this, then one of the things all the ships would be qualified for would be they would get their certificate to hang in the wheelhouse. Show people that they meet it. They would also have their vessel names posted on the Port State Control website for the Coast Guard as being quality ships. Then we get specific with respect to what we would do for tank ships, for freight ships, and passenger vessels. For tank ships, this is where the incentive is more strictly on the federal level. Tank ships, if they're in this program, they would have their certificate of compliance be valid for 2 years, and they would have reduced inspections. Freight ships would have 2 years, again, of limited port state control oversight. So if you're there on that quality ship list, you're going to get much less attention from Al Eccles when he goes out and tries to target who he's going to be inspecting. The only ones that don't get a real good benefit out of this are passenger vessels. They don't get any reduced inspections. All they essentially get is the recognition. But that's something that I just took off, just found out about this today. That's going to be going into effect this way at the national level. But the incentive there is strictly on essentially recognition and reduced federal oversight.
Okay, that's interesting.
Can I ask Captain Hotmaker a question? And then, so it's just based on, how do you determine what's a quality ship?
Well, I didn't know how much time you wanted to take. I'll just read them real quick. It has to be a non-U.S. flag vessel. Must have no substandard vessel detentions in the U.S. within the previous 36 months. Must have no marine violations or serious marine casualties in the U.S. within the previous 36 months. Must have a successful port state control exam within the previous 12 months. Must not be owned or operated by any company associated with any port state control detention in U.S. waters within the previous 24 months. So that's ties into our targeted companies list that we have. Must not be classed by or have their statutory convention certificate issued by a targeted classification society. That ties right into our targeted class society that we've had problem vessels. Must not be registered with a flag state that has a detention ratio more than one-third of the overall U.S. detention ratio. So that's, and the vessel's flag state must have at least 10 distinct arrivals in each of the previous 3 years. So that, again, ties to the targeted flag state. And that's the criteria. So it just would result in the Coast Guard paying less attention to your vessel.
Can we have that, please? That piece of paper?
Sure. I copy it all.
Okay.
Just to follow up, I mean, it seems it contains a lot of the elements that we were talking about,
yeah.
Except it only applies to foreign vessels.
Right.
So again, it's another model. You know, this is one. That's another one. If we want to do something, but you know, to do that, you have to wait, or you have to lay out the specific issues. So the policy question is it worth taking the time to put a weighting and a classification tier 1, 2, and 3 together to get a prevention program, or is that too much trouble and we just want to forget about it?
Well, that's
the policy issue.
Yeah, that is the policy call. And this whole second half of this meeting is supposed to address those issues should we decide to do that. I'm Scott Cotter, and then maybe O'Hara.
Thanks. In response to Joe's comment on the spot charter, of us having the luxury of, well, if you don't meet the five-star program, then we don't want you. I'm not sure how familiar you are with the availability of the spot charter fleet, but it is not that we don't have that luxury. They're
okay.
Not there. We sell our cargo, as I've stated before. We need a certain date to move it. So we have to take what ships, and as Captain O'Hara knows, occasionally we wind up with a brand new ship, maiden voyage, top of the line, best crew, best company, and occasionally we get a lower class ship. I'll leave that one kind of there. And as far as the new program, I was wondering as the Coast Guard thought, or if you even knew on your experience in Cook Inlet, how almost any of our carriers that
seen them. I don't know that any of those would make this new program. That's pretty stringent.
From you sit down with the numbers, I
can have.
Yeah.
That's a
pretty stringent list. For not the one he just described.
Correct.
The program, yeah. O'Hara?
It's pretty stringent, but it's all based on history and the historical perspective of the ships. But as far as weighting this thing, I don't think we have to weight the measures, with exception of the double hull. But tier 1, 2, 3, it could be meet 4, 8, all of them, rather than weight the thing for 100% this. And, you know, the double hull in my mind automatically tier 3 or separate, but contained like tilt chip.
So that'd be another way of approaching it, rather than weight each one. So you've got the list for your classification. If you're a container ship and you meet 4 out of the 12, you're a 1. If you meet 8 out of 12, or if you meet all of them, or whatever. Just another way about weighting.
Double hull automatically gets you the...
Yeah.
Are people... Oh, sorry. Sandy, yes?
Back to my point. It seems like the fleet that I certainly am concerned about, which are the ships that come into our waters who aren't familiar, and which often are the spot charter ships. They are not American flag vessels. They come once every blue moon or so. And I think if we look at the groundings, we will find that certainly they've had their fair share. I just don't know that, as Scott says, and as I've come to understand, whether you're at Greens Creek, whether you're at Cominco, whether you're at Utes Valley, whomever you are looking at spot charters, you don't get to just say, you don't always get your pick of the litter. Instead, you get chosen by what ship you can get to come all the way to Alaska to pick up your one-third a ship full of cargo or whatever you've got that you're sending out. So I still question if going through all of the writing it would take to do a state recognition program for those ships is when it's just a recognition program, and we know that many of these ships can't meet it. Losing the Captain Hunt Markers list, I know that a lot of those charter vessels are not going to be able to meet that list because I've looked at their experiences in other ports in over the past year or two, because we did it when we had 273, and we got a whole bunch of ships that never get to come back to Alaska if we had a way to say you can't come. I still don't know that. There's a cost benefit here of doing any of this stuff, and I question, I think a recognition program, just a recognition program by the state, doesn't get you an actual prevention credit. And if so, I question whether it's going to be that useful to the industries we're talking about, whether they really are going to care that much about getting it, and whether it's worth just going through the time it would take. If you're carrying human cargo, I think it would make a lot more sense. Whether it's a six-pack, whether it's a cruise ship, and Captain Hunt Marcus said, you know, that the Fed's not even giving recognition. They're not allowing any sort of demonstrable lessening of their oversight of ferries and ships to carry human cargo. So I think that we've gone through a lot of discussion about the program that still doesn't provide tangible benefits that are commensurate with the amount of time it would take to put one together and the difficulty that DC would have, or the Coast Guard would have, having to go out and try to inspect whether or not we were meeting this, to put a piece of paper on the bridge, where, frankly, very few people have ever been on the bridge for one of these ships. So are they ever going to see that piece of paper? They're not. The insurance companies might like it, but we've already talked about trying to do something with insurance rates. And frankly, if you can do something with rates, who cares about the piece of paper on the wall? Which would you rather have? Wouldn't you rather have your rates lower than a piece of paper on the wall? Mm-hmm. I just think that's the nature of the beast and the nature of business.
We took co-ops off the list, but yeah, they're in the mix as well. Scott?
just wanted to reiterate on what Senator Pierce said. We actually do have ships owners now, companies that won't call in Alaska after this past winter. They refuse to come back during certain months of the year. So our list is actually shrinking in the selection of what ships we do have.
So am I saying that we don't have consensus on the state recognition program? Am I hearing that? Are we hearing no consensus on that one?
Sorry.
Are we hearing a no consensus verdict on the state recognition program? Everybody go like this or go like this. All at the same time.
Don't be democratic.
Can we ask the ADEC what's this going to cost? Is it going to?
You're saying no consensus. So if you nod your head and it yes, that means no.
That means
and
no.
Didn't we decide? We don't have consensus, but we have a consensus for a no program. Is that what you're saying?
I don't know. You all have to go like this or like this at the right time.
What's it going? Ms. O'Hara, what's it going to cost? Is it going to cost extra people? Is it going to cost?
By the way, the 470 fund free cent side is already all spent.
Automatic.
What does the Green Star program cost? And you know, I heard something on the news this morning about one of the DEC award programs. What does it cost to do that now?
The Green Star program is through your Chamber of Commerce.
Chamber,
it's
okay.
A nonprofit that operates that.
There was one, a DEC one this morning.
Pollution prevention award,
yeah.
Probably.
Cost to administer that?
Well, the recognition, I mean, again, this all depends on how we build it, is the bottom line. The simplest one that we, again, we discussed earlier meeting would be we've got a list of prevention measures. We have the opportunity to nominate other ones, and the department, under that scenario, the department didn't do any screening for who's eligible for award. In other words, if you were a vessel owner, these are in the rules. And it was a self-nomination process. You send it in the department. The department reviews it. It checks off. If you've got these three, we print out a recognition certificate. And to keep integrity in process, you periodically spot check some of the ones coming in the door just to make sure that, you know, the system has integrity. That would be it. So that was the low-budget way of doing that program. So that would be minimal. And it then depend, you know, if you got into a four-star, five-star, then you got to start sorting all this stuff out, and then it gets more complex if you build a more elaborate system. So that would be the bottom end on the recognition system. That would be pretty simple. Cost.
But ultimately, what is, going back to what Senator Pierce said, what's the benefit?
Well, that's the issue here. I think the issue is whether or not, I mean, you can structure any of these simple or complex, I believe. The issue here is I think the issue is whether or not a recognition program provides the power you need in an incentive to get people to actually put a prevention measure on. And certainly of all the ones here, it's the one that has no cash value. It's a peer pressure type incentive.
Yeah.
And so,
so looking at the question that Charlotte raised, is there anyone that objects to striking this from the list? There is objections. We don't have a consensus to strike.
No.
We don't have a consensus at all. Well, I think what we should do, here's what I think we should do. I think we need a break, number one. And I think that we should put this into a little category of no consensus yet and go to the other parts of the discussion, because I think that that's where we have to go now. I think we need to look at the list. I think I'm not going to be here, so good luck. And
Heather, before we move on, if I can make one point, you know.
Does everybody think that's a good idea to say? Is that okay with everybody? Because then you've got the whole other discussion to have of the actual measures and so forth. And maybe at the end of that, it'll be much clearer, and Larilla will be the sole representative of the fishing industry.
No, I'm not with Paul.
I know, we do. So I'd like to take a break.
I don't think we have 100% consensus on anything else on that. No, we've had a general consensus all along.
I didn't see any disagreement when I raised it, I have to say, but I don't disagree with you.
Heather, if I could make one point before we break. We did, since we did leave tax credits on the board and some other things, we don't know what the insurance industry is going to come back with, but possible fuel tax or reductions of spills. fines. If we're going to do that, we're still going to need some kind of a matrix like this. We're going to need to wait. We're going to wait, need to wait it. So before, you know, we completely disregard this, if we do go to some of the other credits, we're going to have some kind of a tier 1, 2, 3 system to implement the tax credits. Well, if we do that, and we're already going to the trouble to do that, then maybe an award program is just like an add-on that then doesn't cost you very much if you're going to already do these other things. If we're going to flush them down the toilet too, then you might as well just throw the whole thing out. But if we go back and we want to do tax credits, then we'll have to do some kind of a weighting system and just go through that and, you know, identify which of the ones we think are real prevention.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't know. I still say there's no consensus on this one particular thing.
Yeah, I agree with you there.
Is that okay? But I don't think that it's the same thing as saying we're throwing this out.
Right.
Was that your point?
Yeah, that's all I'm
okay.
saying.
Yeah.
Stephanie Matheson. Paul, I think that it also depends on what the tax credits fall out. I mean, we haven't even talked about if it's, you know, you meet 8 out of the 10 and you get, you know, this tax credit.
Right.
Or maybe there's just one standard tax credit that, you know, you meet any of these above things and you get a 5% tax credit or something. I guess
right.
I'm not convinced yet that having to wait to get the tax credit, that we've really talked about that. And I think it's the way that you craft the tax credit that would depend on whether it'd be necessary to wait.
I agree.
And I would say that I am hesitant to wait without some guidance, apparently DEC.
I agree completely. We need lots more information before we can do anything that complex.
Yeah, mine was just the framework.
Right.
If we're going to do any of these, then we need some kind of a framework. It could be as simple as if you meet one of any of these, then you get it.
Yeah.
But if you go beyond that, then you need to wait and lay out some kind of a tier 1, 2, 3 system or something.
If you decide to do it.
Yes. Right.
Is everybody okay with taking a break now?
Lunch,
yeah. 12:30, and I unfortunately do have to leave. And good luck. Seriously, I wasn't being suspicious.
Is that housekeeping before we go?
No housekeeping, just 1:30, we'll be back.
We'll drive safely.
Have fun in Alaska.
Are there any additional measures that people feel should be included that are not on this list? Scott?
Scott Carter with Last Dimension Products. Wanted to bring up a possible point or maybe something to consider for the splash rider market that does not have that much control over the vessels, maybe having credits such as dock configuration or maybe mooring configuration, because that is a liability or area there, when prevention is taken while at the berth, it could be applied.
Absolutely. So put that on as number 21.
Okay, it seems like the mooring
lines. Yeah, the type of mooring lines maybe, or maybe the number of lines, or additional pilot, or,
even the angle of the dock, the perpendicular and parallel dock.
Maybe having perhaps just a matrix for when you will or will not berth the ship, or we can...
You mean criteria for?
Go ahead, Jeff.
Can we generically characterize all of that as mooring plans? Does that capture it?
Yeah, mooring considerations, plans, whatever. Sure.
Okay. Any other additional measures? Yes.
Larry Dietrich of DEC. Yeah, I would suggest, we talked before, like we're leaving the door open, so that there's one that's not on the list that can be brought forth by any vessel, any operator or vessel group. So it seems to me we ought to have a placeholder on here then that says...
self-proposed.
Other.
Other. Yeah, right.
Okay.
An other line or something like that, so that it's clear that... or maybe even some tech to say other measure as may be proposed.
Their proposed measures. Okay, any additional measures? Okay, the next part of the drill is to go down by category and say which of these measures we feel could be met by this classification of vessels. Emergency tow line or dedicated mooring line for a fishing vessel? Yes.
Sure.
Emergency onboard dewatering petroleum pumps? Yes. Onboard storage bladder or dedicated tank? Fishing vessel could meet that.
Dedicated tank? Like
What do you mean by designated?
Avoid.
Would you, to where you could pump, if you had one tank ruptured somewhere on the vessel, you'd identify you could pump oil to. Wouldn't be a separate bladder, but maybe it'd be another storage tank somewhere that you could say, could identify.
How about the fish hold?
Or a fish hold, for that matter.
Fish hold.
Fish hold, yeah. But it's not going to be like a dedicated, that was my question on that. It's not a dedicated tank. There'd be other options.
Yeah.
Well, I would suggest, this is Jeff Thompson, that maybe you might want to change that rather than dedicated to identified.
Identified. Okay, non-contiguous tank location on vessel.
Rarely.
What's that?
Rarely,
right?
Rarely, yeah.
So do we want to leave it off as a standard? I mean, it'd be so unusual that a fishing vessel would. Okay. Redundant propulsion systems? No.
Some do. Depends on the vessel.
Okay, then we want to check that, yes. Redundant or integrated navigation systems. They could meet that. Use of an Alaska Marine pilot when not otherwise required by law. No. And training a sponder or a transponder or other vessel location ID technology. They could meet that. Use of advanced anchoring systems or placement of mooring buoys.
What definition are we going to use?
Well, I think you say any catcher boat or catcher processor.
Okay.
And we get a separate classification for if it's just a mothership, fish processor.
But remembering that it's at a size that comes under the law, which is...
Over 400 tons.
Oh, right. Well, I understand that. No, I don't know if any
Okay, use of routes that avoid proximity to shoreline hazards and environmentally sensitive areas. What's that? Can do that.
We can do for routes, but not operations. In other words, transit to and from or places of operations, we can go, and I know what you're going to say, we can do if the weather's okay.
Yeah.
You know, we can do that, but as far as operations themselves, that's a different ballgame.
Mike?
I would like to talk about the scratchy number 9.
9 or 10?
10. 10, excuse me, 10.
Well, you know, we discussed this last time, and some people, you know, felt that they could choose routes that would keep, you know, people offshore. And I think, Larry, you mentioned some of the things that were being done in the tank industry that you felt brought some value to the table.
Yeah, Larry, did you, yeah, I mean, in terms of the, I mean, the classic example of Alaska that I mentioned before was the crude oil tankers, the fact that they have moved 200 miles offshore. I mean, recognizing the captain has ultimate control of the vessel, but from an avoidance, it is a tool that's definitely being pushed on the West Coast and actually in place on the West Coast now. It's one that can be done. It's cost-effective in that usually comes in with the time and fuel consumption, usually of the drivers and what kind of deviation they have to take. But even the non-crew guys use it. So I don't know. I think it's a good tool. But
we're talking 3 miles from. We're not talking 200 miles. You're talking about tankers having to be 200 miles off the coast. We're talking. This body is associated with 3 miles off the coast.
But a vessel could choose to go 20 miles. But I know your issue is also that then you're having regulations dictate the routes rather than the best sailing practice.
Yeah.
Ryan?
Is the question here, I mean, since it's not the actual use of routes that would qualify you for a prevention measure, that you're certifying this, you know, once a year or whatever, it seemed to me it's, are you planning routes that would avoid them? Then in circumstances you might have to deviate for safety reasons and not use your planned route. I assume that's what they do down south. Their planned route may be 200 miles offshore, but if weather or other conditions said that the captain needed to come in, they're not going to stay out no matter what,
yes,
right?
They stay out no matter what.
But they're not required by state or federal law to do that.
They're on AIS. And they don't go inside 200 miles. It doesn't matter what the weather is.
What day?
Automatic independent surveillance.
What does it mean?
Which means there's somebody with a. They send a signal to a satellite. It comes back, bounces back to a console, so that they know where the ship is at all times.
And why does that?
I think the office does for sure, and I don't know if the Coast Guard has that facility in Valdez.
What does that prohibit them from flying close to shore?
Because there's the 200 mile limit. They will not step inside that 200 mile limit no matter what.
Why?
Well, the captain's worried about his job. Who's gonna second guess a guy who goes? I mean, everybody would be second guessing a guy who goes inside the 200 mile limit. Was the weather really that bad? Or are you trying to save fuel? Was the weather really that bad? Or, you know, this is the second time that's happened in your life. Baloney. Oh, by the way, that's O'Hara.
Go ahead.
She didn't know.
Scott Carter, I just had a question on how many waterways would be affected, do we think, by this dedicated route? Like, would Cook Inlet be considered because of its size? And there's not really much of a deviance from where you're going anyway.
There's O'Hara. Yes, Cook Inlet would be affected, potentially be affected. Jim Carter is, the RCAC is talking about making Homer a sanctuary of some sort. Well, that's also at the pilot station. Now, there's going to be a conflict there. And this thing will, and ADEC is very amenable right now. This administration seems to want to work with industry and pilots and all the rest of this stuff. A new administration can take this wording and make whatever it wants out of it.
On Cook Inlet, don't we have shipping lanes?
Lanes per se?
Yeah.
No.
So we can go anywhere we want to go as long as
we
keep.
Well, we did the triple beam surveys on the 2 mile wide going in after the Glacier Bay thing.
Yeah.
Aren't we supposed to stay within those, that 2 mile corridor?
There's no official, I mean, we do. We stay in the where the water's deep. What's that got to do with?
But that's selecting a route.
Well, no, I could go north of the shoal and come around down through the rigs. So we just have to use the southern one. If it's a deep draft ship, then we'll use the northern one.
Yeah.
I think from our perspective, I mean, this is, again, we're on the voluntary side of the equation here, and I hear what you're saying on how this can be subject to interpretation, but the reason all of these things are on the voluntary list was when we got started in this, we said that one of the premises was to avoid intertanko issues, and clearly navigation is one where the state would be preempted. I mean, the state, I don't see how the state could ever impose a shipping lane or mandatory route without getting totally sideways with the captain before. Really is the only one that can make that call. I mean, it is a totally voluntary. I just like them from a spill prevention, and it gives us time to react, and that's why I like it. As a possibility.
Senator Pierce?
Two things. I'm thinking of the person who works for DEC who's not a mariner and is trying to figure out when a plan is brought in or when a proposal for a prevention credit is brought in, whether that route is safe, not safe. Or if you don't know anything about the marine industry, what the captain has just been talking about is way over your head, and so I don't know how we could assign any sort of objective percentages or anything to this. So it's sounding more and more difficult in terms of trying to use it as a prevention measure, except that I think we do have the ability, don't we, as part of the planning process, if they come in and say, we will not go near this refuge or this estuary, or we will make sure that we have equipment ready here ready to be deployed because this is one of the habitats that we have to protect. Is that the way you really protect?
Yeah. I mean, if you stay, if you got a sense of a zone and you, if you go close by it, it might drive the need for pre-positioning equipment or help to protect it if you stay away from it. You would need pre-positioning because you would have the reaction time. That's kind of your gun.
So I guess as part of your contingency planning process in terms of equipment needs, you probably get to this and you're sure. But we certainly, I don't think it's up to us to decide whether somebody ought to be 200 miles offshore or 100 miles offshore.
Go ahead, Doug.
Well, the other thing I can think of is that are you coming near shore 10% of your trip, if not 90%? You're making a 10-mile voyage versus a 1,000-mile voyage, and you can stay way out for most of it, but don't choose to do that. I think that would, it'd be really hard to put a weight on it, I think. I don't disagree with what Larry's saying. I think it's a great idea, but I think it would almost have to be one that I just don't know how you would weight it compared to some of these other things. The other ones are a little more easy to if there's something you can put your hands on, you can touch them, you can feel them, and there's something of value there. This is just a planning thing.
Well, I guess the other possibility is if we did remove it, somebody could come in under other proposed and say, my special conditions say I'll stay off here or something, and a department could agree to it that way.
There's a lady out here in the audience.
Yes, go ahead, ma'am.
I just want to mention the only, just very damning for him and our CNC, the only time even with far charters or any other vessels coming into containment that I've seen DEC put restrictions on is coming through Shellcock Strait, that that would be a shorter route for some of those vessels. So that's been a consistency that we've seen with the other regulated vessels.
That's a very good example, and is a if there's a southwest or blow, a southeaster blowing out there, a ship heads out there, rather than staying in a lee of an island, he's putting himself in more danger by going east of Kodiak Island. Yes, it does.
Okay, we need to reach a consensus here and see, we're prepared to move on. So I guess I'd just say, how many people believe that number 10 should stay in as a measure, as a prevention measure? Larry? And how many think we ought to go ahead and remove it? So I think almost everybody says remove it. Can you be persuaded so we can, they could put it under other proposed and come in under a special?
Well, yeah, I think we follow Brian's rules, I guess, in these situations, right, Brian?
Right, half force members.
Okay. All right, then we're scratching 10. 11, vetting program.
No.
Okay, compliance with bridge safety management practices, International Safety Management Code before July 2002. This does not apply to that. Participation in risk assessment process for operations.
Yes.
Membership in a marine safety organization. Yes. Tugboat staged on standby. No. Additional staged equipment onshore to improve RPS. Possibly.
Yeah, that's a possibility.
You know, say Trident could have some stuff at the plant there or something in Akutan or.
We do.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, that's a good example.
I'm just thinking of some of the smaller companies. They probably don't.
Okay, weather oceanographic equipment and systems.
Beyond what's required?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
This is almost beyond what's
required.
Yeah.
Is there like a contract to
use that? I don't know. Charlotte, you're the one who brought this up. Could you tell us exactly what you're talking about there?
I think I keep trying to add a tag in there that you either have additional equipment or you have contracted with someone who can give you additional there's something that improves you beyond requirements, improves that equation from your above and beyond requirements.
I mean, we carry quite a bit already.
And you may already carry more.
But I don't know if it goes beyond. I mean, we don't even.
I mean, all that's required is a fax machine by the Coast Guard, right, so that you can get a fax transmission on the weather. So what you're talking about is an advanced system of, you know, tying in with somebody that is giving you more real-time data or something.
Or if you're, you know, docking a certain area, if you have some current meters out there that you can do really immediate.
Tide and current.
Tide and
current. That's not So I don't think it really applies
to
fishing.
To hire an ice expert.
No. Enhanced maintenance?
Yes.
Ice classification. No. Specialized onboard trading programs and prevention and response. Yes. Mooring plans? Probably not. See how it really realistically applies. Okay, now we're to fish processing.
So just a point, so that we have 11 measures that we've identified, not counting other proposed measures that might come from the industry. So for the fishing vessels group, we have 11 is sort of the maximum that anyone could get. If we're looking at tiering, we can deal with that later.
So we can set the threshold at 12, right?
Okay, fish processors, emergency tow line, yes. Onboard dewatering, yes. Onboard bladder or identified tank, yes. Non-contiguous tank location on vessel. Not? No. Redundant propulsion systems. I think they could. Integrated navigation systems, yes. Use of an Alaska Marine pilot when not otherwise required, yes. They could use an Alaska Marine pilot when not otherwise required. You know, if they want to, you know, they're coming into Dutch or something like that, they can ask for a pilot on board. I'm thinking like the Ocean Phoenix or something like that.
The Ocean Phoenix is the only one that would even want to put that in that ball game. To make that, if this is all going to be a standard that we want to achieve, it might not be required, but it's an achievable thing. None of us use pilots if we don't have to. Unnecessary cost. Most of our vessels, especially ones that process the vessels, are maneuverable enough by themselves, unless you need a tug to come alongside. You know, besides the Ocean Phoenix, you're looking at about, you know, 350 feet.
Big mothership?
Yeah, that's about 350 feet. Ocean Phoenix is just a...
So if it only applies to one vessel, what was it? Yes, Charlotte?
Just kind of policy for everyone, maybe if there's situations like this where it would only apply to a small handful of the quote-unquote fleet, then it could fall under other...
Yes, okay, that's a good idea. Okay, Brian, there's a point?
Point in the back.
He's shaking his head. No. Okay, maintaining a transponder, yes. Advanced anchoring system, replacement of mooring buoys, yes. I mean, and this is often employed by these guys when they anchor up in a particular harbor. Vetting program, no. Big safety management practices, no. Risk assessment for operations, yes. Membership in a marine safety organization, yes. Tugboat staged on standby, no. Go ahead.
Excuse me, this is Jeff Thompson. Actually, I was thinking of the Impala and you know, the Icicle fleet, but those are unpowered barges, so would apply.
Right.
Okay, additional stage equipment on shore. Yes. Yeah. Weather oceanographic equipment and systems.
No.
Enhanced maintenance. Yes. Ice classification. No. Onboard training programs, prevention and response, yes. Mooring plans.
You're going to include that mooring buoy.
Yeah, I think it could, yeah. Okay, now.
So we have a total there of 13 items for the processors as opposed to the fishing.
Now, we get to general cargo. One issue that's come up, and I'm going to have to wait for Charlotte to go through this. Okay, what we'll do, let's continue to go through general cargo. When she comes back, we're going to address the issue whether spot charters need to be in a separate category. And we may add another spot charter category on this. So general cargo, we're talking about LNG ships, reefer vessels and ore ships that might come on a regular basis. Okay, emergency tow line, yes. Onboard dewatering pumps, yes. Identified tank or bladder, yes.
Excuse me, Paul.
Do I have
charter? We're going to address spot charters. Wait, this isn't concerning.
Well, I'm just saying if you're prepared, I thought since Charlotte was out of the room, we should. Do you think that it ought to be a separate category?
I have questions if, like, say, for the emergency dewatering pump, is this something I could put on my ship and haul her, but the crew has never seen it, may not know how to use it? I mean, I can easily stick a small container or package on a ship that has a line and a dewatering pump in it at home. But whether that's a prevention credit, I mean.
Well, then let's just address it. I mean, Charlotte's out on the phone. I mean, I think we've heard kind of enough information around the table all day today that spot charters the vessel that come in one or two times, you don't even know where it's coming from, is kind of in its own category. Would people have a problem creating a spot charter column in this? Okay, we'll just do that. So, Scott, we will address that separately. A non-contiguous tank location on vessel, yes.
You've done it. If you've taken spot charters out, who are the general cargo ships?
General cargo is all LNG tankers, all the reefer vessels that come through on a regular basis, the ore carriers that would come on a regular basis.
Those are spot charters.
Some are. Tom Reuter, North Star.
I would say, with the exception of the LNG ships and the container ships, that you can classify almost all the rest of them as spot charters. Some reefer vessels are dedicated generally to Alaska, may have 2 to 5 voyages in a year, but there's almost everything that you just listed there is once or twice in a year.
So, and then the other thing that we've heard and talked about just that might fit into some of these is maybe you want spot charters that call less than 3 times a year. And maybe that breaks out the difference between them and somebody who is coming on a regular basis. Because a vessel, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jeff, it's a reefer ship, that they know they're going to come back and back and back to Alaska all year, then it may be worth it for them to say, I'm going to look at putting some of this prevention stuff on because I'm there enough to make it worth it for me to do it. Jeff Thompson.
The way to differentiate this is through the charter mechanism itself. Spot charter generally is a one-time, one-off cargo arrangement with a ship that is nearby or handy for that cargo at that given point in time. The reefer ships in Western Alaska are generally time chartered. And although there's variations, as Tom pointed out, in terms of, you know, you can have subsets of that in terms of space chartering. In other words, the competitor will use space on another vessel for a special circumstance. But generally, these vessels are time chartered for a period of time, and therefore there's much more planning involved with their voyages. And the same can be said for log ships. The same can be said for bulk carriers, as well as those categories could also be in what's really... A spot charter is more accurately called a voyage charter under most circumstances. I think the way to differentiate this, I think it does need to be differentiated, would be to come up with, I think, vessels that are trading to Alaska more than once a year. Not 3 times, even twice a year. Because, for example, a reefer tramper can come once during the winter pollock season and pick up cargo, then come back and do a combination of herring and salmon. Often that same ship will come 3 or 4, probably as Tom said, 5 times, but it could come 2 times and still be considered a regular trainer, just depending upon market conditions and other factors. But the vessels that are called off the ocean, the world sees, say, okay, we have a cargo for you in Alaska, go get it. That is really, I think, what we're talking about when we talk about spot charters. Or, you know, again, more technically known as voyage charters. And I think that those need to be treated separately as a column here than vessels that are under other circumstances and have more familiarity with Alaska.
Okay, further discussion on splitting out voyage charters, and what do we want to say, more than once a year, 3 times a year? Charlotte?
I don't know how it works. I'm just concerned that possibly you have occasions when a spot charter comes in twice in the same year on a cruise.
You do.
Oh, yeah.
No.
There's no doubt about that.
So why then would you want to limit it to once a year? If usually they're once a year, but occasionally you have one that comes in twice a year, then how do you deal with that?
The spot charter, the whole definition of spot charter, though, or whatever, is that we don't know if that ship is going to be back. It's the luck of the draw. We can't plan for it, for that ship. So it really, I don't really know that you need to count them as such, I mean, because you don't know.
Jeff Thompson, well, if the number of times in Alaska isn't really a good differentiating criteria, I think it's something else. But basically, you're right in the fact that the vessel doesn't know it's coming to Alaska, except in a very short time frame. And if it came back twice, again, it would not be because it was under a time charter and it had been planned out to make two voyages.
Right.
That's the real differentiating point. I don't know how to define that in terms of the legislation or how we would recommend it to a task force.
Boats that are contracted in an opportunistic manner, is that captured? Is that going to
well, if we call it voyage charter, and I think that kind of, and remember this whole program, what we're doing, on one side, you might look at this, well, geez, you know, are they going to be required or look bad if they do some of these things? On the other hand, this is as an incentive program. And these vessels, if they come here enough, are going to then want to say, well, geez, maybe it's worth it for me to jump through some of these hoops. So I might get a reduced insurance rate or something like that. So we don't want to exclude vessels that might want to participate to take advantage of the incentives.
Yeah, I just don't want someone to get pigeonholed somewhere.
Paul, Mike's got
Go ahead, Mike.
Besides, if you limit the number to the number of trips, there are some ships, for example, I had one brand new ship. He would want prevention credit. I mean, this whole thing seems to be designed for because you expect to get the bottom of the barrel, but. My experience, especially the ships that go to Cominco, they got to go to Japan.
I realize that.
And they're, we were talking about that at lunch, they're terrific ships.
They are. And right now, zinc is a high-priced commodity.
If they trade in Japan, they've got to meet their standards.
That could be, but I'm not here for Cominco, so I'm here for the industry, and not everyone is in that position. And we're not expecting that they're all bad, but what we're saying is, basically, this will come back on the people using the ship. If there's an award out there or something, it will reflect more on, well, what's this company here doing? What kind of shipping are they doing? Do their boats have these awards or not? And we don't have control over it. You know? And that's the main point, is you're asking us to buy into something we don't have control over.
Tom Reuter in the back.
Tom Reuter, just some of the issues here that you've got listed up here, again, are obviously aimed towards new buildings, one. It's something that isn't something that somebody can go in as a retroactive retrofit matter. Some of them are obviously, as discussed, if you're going to be here 6 months out of the year, it's going to be more cost effective to be able to do that. And perhaps there's a kind of a timeline that needs to be looked at in the sense of, is this vessel going to be here 3 days on a spot charter to load two holes of fertilizer, whatever, or load half a load of logs, or is it going to be here for a month, as frequently reefer vessels are, and it's only one voyage, but they're here for an extended period of time, leaving their exposure bigger for problems that we look at here. I mean, so maybe just trying to group everything as a spot charter or a voyage charter or however that might be is maybe the wrong interpretation of it.
On the other hand, if we call it voyage charter, I think that's the cleanest way to do it, as long as we understand this is a vessel that's called on short notice. That's the defining factor. That's what makes it hard for them to meet a program, because they don't even know they're coming here. They don't even know that the program exists. So if we say voyage charter, this is somebody that's contracted on short notice off the world market available vessels. And I think that gives us the breakdown that we need to separate them out.
Well,
So can we agree on that? We're going to call them voyage charter, and I think that gives us a classification that we need. Okay, so now we're back to general cargo. Redundant propulsion systems, yes, they could have that. Integrated navigation systems, yes. Use of an Alaska Marine pilot when out of the required by law, yes. Transponder, yes. Anchoring systems or placement of mooring buoys, yes. Vetting program, yes.
I assume so.
I would think that the vetting program for a regular caller, I mean, the vetting program is primarily for voyage charters.
For voyage charters?
And,
okay.
Regular callers don't do vetting.
Okay.
It's owned by the company or whatever.
That's a good point. Safety management. Go ahead, Jeff.
I was just going to add a comment that that's true. If a vessel is going to be time chartered for a year in Alaska trade, it's going to go through a ostensible vetting program anyway, but I think the intent of a vetting program as a prevention measure really applies more to a voyage charter vessel.
Okay. Okay, bridge safety management practices. Yep. ISMC before 2002, that's a yes.
Yes.
Risk assessment process for operations. Yes, marine safety organization, yes. Tugboat staged on standby. I don't know.
I don't either.
During what?
Yeah.
In fact, nobody has checked this yet. Does this apply to anybody? Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, Jeff Thompson, tugs stage and standby are circumstantial. That maybe, for example, we recently had a reefer vessel that lost power. It was loading Jack Bay down in Valdez, and for a day we had a tug go out and standby because the Coast Guard required it. But so it's a circumstantial thing, and as far as I can't think of a situation where it's routinely used except in circumstances like the TAPS trade or something like that. I can know again, my experience in Western Alaska is that it's only under special, a dead ship or other circumstances that a tug would be void.
You're not going to have somebody sit there waiting for one of your vessels to need them. How about the container ships? You're not doing that either.
Well,
so they are.
We actually use them. They're not on standby. They're actually contracted. We use them to dock.
How about an LNG ship?
No.
I guess then the question is, are we the only ones that use them?
So that may be out for the container.
Could be. All right.
Yeah.
And if so, we'd like to leave it on the list.
All right. Okay, additional staged equipment onshore to improve RPS. Think of a situation where that applied to a general cargo vessel. Not hearing any. Weather oceanographic equipment and systems? Yes. Enhanced maintenance? Yes. How about ice classification? Some of these could, huh? LNG ships. Specialized training, onboard training and prevention and response? Yes. Mooring plans? Yes.
We have 17 measures in this group.
Okay, cruise ships. Tow line, yes. Pumps, yes. Ladder identified tank, yes. Non-contiguous tank location on vessel.
I don't think it would fit in with the arrangements of a cruise ship because they'd want to use that for cargo. I mean, for cargo.
Are any of the new ones have any of that in their design?
They're
building lots of new cruise ships.
They're all double bottom.
Just as simple as another tank.
Are they?
You use the fuel and you're just looking for
that would be this
product.
It's not really double hull. It's just that you build it so the fuel tank is not right next to the outside skin of the.
I don't know about the new construction.
And just in general, I just know that the trends in naval architecture have been to move tanks inboard and away from the skin. Mm-hmm. And I think from a general standpoint, you can say that, that would, almost all new ships are moving their, wherever possible, moving their fuel tanks away from the skin of the ship.
Well, let's mark it, and I'll be sure and check with the cruise people and make sure this is not something that's completely impossible.
Yeah.
Redundant propulsion, twin screws on these ships, Nav systems, yes. Use of an Alaska Marine pilot when not otherwise required by law. Some of the American, transponder, yes. Anchoring systems or placement of mooring buoys. They keep moving. They don't really anchor up, do they?
Well, actually, they do.
No, they do anchor quite a bit in the southeast, especially. Yeah.
But would it be an anchoring system or a mooring plan for them?
Usually it's an anchoring system.
Okay.
My guess is those two keep overlapping.
It's anchoring systems, replacement of mooring buoys.
Mooring buoys or mooring plans.
Well, it doesn't refer back to fishing vessels. We get a yes in advanced anchoring and a no in mooring consideration, so I don't know if we could.
Okay, we got to keep them split. Go ahead, Jeff.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think a mooring buoy is a lot different than a mooring plan. And basically, a mooring plan would relate to the line configuration of the dock, for example. Or a mooring buoy is basically a solid anchor that's there, and you know it has a known quality as far as its holding ability.
Okay, use of routes that avoid proximity, no.
We dropped that completely.
Vetting program, no. Bridge safety management for 2002.
They're already required.
It's already required.
Yeah.
So that's a no. Risk assessment, yes. Safety organization, yes. Tugboat staged on standby.
Yes, they could.
Yeah, they do. I know they do in Juneau and Ketchikan and wherever the main ports that they're calling in. Additional staged equipment on shore.
Do they do that?
Oceanographic equipment or weather, yes. Enhanced maintenance, yes. Ice classification.
Some cruise ships have ice classification.
Yeah, that's right. Onboard training, yes. Mooring plans, yeah. That's what you'd call in Juneau, where they lay that hole. They got six ships laying in there. Where are they going to put them, Judy?
Yeah, I just had a question back on the number 9. What did you say on that?
Yeah, they could, yes, for cruise ships.
So we have 18 items on the cruise ships.
Okay, on the container ships. Emergency tow line, yes. Pumps, yes. Identified tank or bladder, yes. Non-contiguous tank location, yes. Redundant propulsion, yes. Integrated nav systems, yes. Use of a marine pilot when not other required by law, yes.
Sure.
Transponder, yes. Anchoring system or placement of mooring buoys? No.
Container ships.
Can't think when we ever anchor out.
The container ships in Well,
sometimes we have to stand off because of weather, but we're not anchoring, though.
No, we're under power.
I don't think so.
A vetting program? No.
No.
Bridge safety management practices?
Sure.
Yes. Okay, risk assessment, yes. Safety organization, yes. Tugboats on standby, yes. Additional staged equipment on shore, not aware of any.
Well, we don't do it. Is the question, can we or do we, as a matter of practice?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, anybody can.
How about Dutch Harbor?
Yeah.
But we don't.
Well, there are onshore assets. For example, if CSX was a member of Shadoo and Shadoo has their stuff there.
Well, that's membership in a SR.
This is kind of above and beyond.
This is above and beyond. But you could, in Dutch Harbor, you could put additional stuff at your terminal there or here in Anchorage if you wanted to.
Sure. Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Scott Carter, couldn't we go back and look at the general cargo vessel we have marked so there?
Should be the same way.
Should be the same.
Yes.
Yeah, I think so.
So what I'm going to do, put yes.
General cargo should be a yes on number 16.
Okay, correct.
Okay, oceanographic equipment and systems, yes.
Yep.
Enhanced maintenance,
mm-hmm.
yes. Ice class, yes. Specialized onboard trading, yes.
Yep.
Mooring plans, again, no. does. They never anchor up. I mean, they always go to a dock.
No, no, not mooring buoy.
Okay, but where would you go other than you were going to a dock?
Well, we always have a PU.
Use of wires rather than pulleys.
Doubling up in the ice, long leads in the ice.
Actually, we probably do.
I'm sure. I know you do.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Damn, he's pilot.
You're not the only one who says that.
We've got 18 on container vessels also.
By the way, that was O'Hara that said that.
All right.
Okay, now we are to the classification of voyage charter.
Okay, and I have... As you go down through this, you have the things that tip on the figure. And you're also going to have things that the client could do. Can you clump those together, or do you keep that separate? And that's my whole problem all along, is the complexity of this just makes it unmanageable. They're all good things to do, but who are you going to attribute to?
Wage charter or charterer.
Well, except for, if you're looking at the charterer, he has no control, over the vessel. And if you're looking at the ship owner, they have no control over what the client is doing.
You want a separate category for charterer?
I don't know. I don't want any of this to be quite truthful because I think it's way too complex, but I don't think you can merge them either. So.
Jeff?
I would just suggest that it's, to me anyway, it's evident based upon the actual item. For example, there could be, a tow line could be on a vessel that comes into spot charter, and that's something that the owner is taking care of for whatever reason. Additional staged equipment on shore, obviously, is the terminal or the charter's knowledge, within their purview. And
transponder could be put on at the pilot station.
Well, there are some items that could. You wouldn't be able to tell whether that was the ship, a ship-instigated thing, or whether it's a shore-instigated thing.
Exactly. It's going to be a tough place to draw. This is what the ship owner gets credit for. This is what the client gets credit for. And are you looking to give the client credit?
Scott? This is Scott.
If you looked at other ports.
Seems to be more of incidental credits that they happen to get. If they're picked up on a spot charter basis, they're going to be here in 10 days. There's really nothing that they can do on this list. The owner of the ship.
Unless, of course, it already happened.
Unless it's incidental, that it's on there. They may happen to have a contiguous tank.
No forethought in that.
There is no planning.
Incidental is by luck.
They're not in a port generally to have time to prepare for any of this. They're usually en route somewhere or on the way to Alaska. So it's a lot of it seems dependent on the charter to provide the stuff to the ship on some of the items that they can't, and a lot of them that they can't.
Ed Carter?
Question that I have, I guess, on the spot charter industry is that are we talking about the average ship that comes in on spot charter, comes here once and never comes back again? Are we talking about the average ship regularly does business in Alaska, regular being more than twice a year?
Well, I guess the only data we've gotten, Brian told me this from the vessel data, is we had 300 ships that